Hey everybody, welcome back to Space Force, season three of our analysis of Star Trek, episode by episode or film by film. Our first season was an analysis of the first season of Star Trek Picard. Then we'd spent a season doing every single Star Trek film from one to the 13 of them or 14?
13.
13. And
now fan films counted.
And no. Although that would be a really interesting topic, and I would totally be up for that. And now we're here for prepping for this Discovery Season 3. I'm Jason Chandra, your host.
I'm Jim.
And I'm still Aid.
Still after 3 years. All right.
Still, yeah.
All right, so it's a big week for Star Trek news. In addition to the fact that the first episode of Discovery's third season. Hey, Dale also just joined us. Welcome, Dale. Thanks for welcoming us back. The first episode of season three launches a week from today, as of this podcast recording. And the last episode of the first season of Lower Decks came out just last Thursday. And we got some news about the new show Prodigy, the animated show that's coming on Nickelodeon. Is that right?
Yep, it's a Nickelodeon property.
And Kate Mulgrew is returning, as I presume Admiral Janeway by this point.
Well, they keep calling her Captain.
Okay.
They do. Yeah, they do. In the bump we've seen for it, yeah, they mention her as Captain, and they're pondering where along her timeline this apparently sits because of that reason alone. Yes.
Do we think that she's going to be a recurring character? I mean, the Prodigy sounds like a bunch of kids on this sort of their own starship. She can't be on the starship. That would sort of remove the whole point of having the kids in charge, right?
Well, I think what's going to be from what it sounds like. They've given her all 8 scripts that they've developed so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So she did this talking, the New York Comic Con, Virtual Con just happened this weekend. That's where we got the news.
Yeah.
And she commented that she's already recorded lines for the first 4 episodes, and she just received the full next scripts, and she just read them and said they were lovely.
Well, it sounds like she's in every episode then.
Yeah. The great thing about it is that Star Trek Prodigy has female writers in the room.
Yeah.
At no time has Janeway been written by women.
Oh, really?
To this extent. Like, we've had female novelists, and those female writers on Star Trek, those Jerry Taylor, but those not different female voices on Voyager.
Okay.
Like, yes, women contributed to Voyager in the script writing process, but you have, I think, there's like 3 or 4 staff writers, female staff idols on the team.
One of our watchers.
Was it Jerry Taylor?
Go ahead.
Sorry, go on. I was going to say, was it Jerry Taylor that did the novel? Was it the Mosaic?
Mm-hmm. She did do the Mosaic.
January novel. Yeah.
One of our audience members just suggested Donka, emergency Captain Hologram calling in. So it's going to be Captain Janeway as an emergency hologram.
Well, we've seen enough holograms floating around in Picards. It wouldn't surprise me. So
yeah. I probably not, but it's an interesting idea. I was sort of hoping that maybe she's kind of like the contact that they have. Like, maybe they're lost or they're stranded or they're on a bunch of adventures, but she's like the person that they sort of contact over the comms when they're in trouble or they want advice.
I think by the timeline, the way it sits, that according to what I read today, there is literally a year's gap between Voyager returning and her being Admiral Janeway in the Next Generation movie. So, and that's it. So it's either before Voyager, which would be crazy, or it's that year of missingness.
That's interesting, that
we would kind of fit into.
Maybe she's the rescue captain. Maybe she's the one that's sent from Starfleet to find the kids and help them. And it's like the
which would make sense. Like you say, if you're gonna have an all kid crew or whatever, if that's what they're planning on doing, the idea you can have a constant reference to somebody like Janeway would be silly. But her being the person to try and track them down, that would be something.
Yeah, I kind of think Aid's on to something. Or she's gonna be an antagonist to the kids in the sense that she's the adult. Like if you read Morrison X-Men, It's all like down with the old people. Like that's the whole point of that story.
Yeah.
I kind of think that that's the role that Kate Mulgrew is going to fill, is that she's going to be the standard bearer. She's going to be the thing that they're chafing against.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't mean she's in the wrong.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing that like New Trek sort of loves finding these holes in continuity that we didn't even think were holes. And we'll talk about that when we talk about Discovery in a second. Mm-hmm. And shifting it up. So if they're going to give us the story as to how Janeway goes from being captain of the Voyager to being an admiral, and that's this story, I can see them weaving it in through, like, say, season one or two, however they compress time.
Interesting. So other Star Trek news that we have missed?
Yeah, I can think of one that's quite interesting. The Hanley movie. The guy who is the writer of Fargo apparently has almost like an on hold Star Trek movie, apparently featuring a completely new crew.
Okay,
we're not talking a reboot crew. We're not talking anything else. But the interesting thing, which again it kind of jars me a little bit, is that he's saying that one of his storylines is supposed to be about how the humans are how they work within the Federation.
Okay.
So, and it seems to be they like to, every modern Star Trek story at the moment seems to like the idea of tearing down the Federation rather than it being the Roddenberry utopia. It's like, well, it's bound to be shit, isn't it? It's in the future. It's the, it's kind of annoying in that respect. So I'm hoping they don't basically just go, humans bad, they are terrible, duh, 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 and then try and do that. I hope there's some kind of a bit of subtlety to it. But it'd definitely be interesting, a new crew.
Yeah,
I mean, are they going to have to create some bloody good characters to get people to actually give a shit about them after one movie? So, and where it sits in what universe are we doing? Are we doing Kelvinverse new crew? Are we doing classic Trek new crew? Are we doing something that's spin off of Picard? I mean, it's like completely up in the air at the moment. So,
I cannot imagine we will ever go back to the Kelvin universe. At least not in a decade or two until somebody as you noted, Jim, like you described it as blank spots in the continuity. I think of it as just Star Trek's version of Just So stories. Like they see something and they have to explain, well, why is the Star Trek universe like this? Why do Vulcans have pointy ears? And then they have to get an episode about why Vulcans have pointy ears, you know? Go ahead.
Sorry, Jason, go.
No, please.
I was gonna say all I said when I was read today was there was mention of this new movie literally being a tie-in factor to the television series and the movies. So there is going to be some cross-pollination there. So whether or not this is going to be, because there was always talk about like the time travel idea of the Kelvinverse volume 4 would be going back to see his father, which again could have reset the timeline so that it kind of like just pops it in a little pocket bubble and that's it. So whether or not we're going to see something like that and it's going to weave its way through, I can't believe they want to abandon the Picard verse because, which is effectively the same timeline, although I refuse to acknowledge the fact that it is the same timeline as Lower Decks, and Voyager DS apparently took us there somewhere along the line as well. But I think that's what they're going to do. But apparently, according to, again, they've got plans for Star Trek stuff up to 2027 as well, which is completely mind-blowing. So we shall see.
Well, the Marvel Universe was kind of a 10-year, 15-year project, right? Like, they didn't know it was going to be quite as big as it was when Iron Man, the first Iron Man film came out. But eventually, they figured out it was. And they had to plan pretty far ahead. But anyway.
Well, yes, to the Haley script that Aid's talking about.
Yeah.
This is the man who also did the Legion TV show.
Oh.
And the Legion TV show gave us an adaptation of the Muir Island saga from the X-Men that was smart and intelligent and knew what to keep, what to get rid of, what to play up, what to downplay for those themes.
And
it's so smart that I sat there gobsmacked watching that full season.
Yeah.
Just going like, oh my God, I can't believe that this story is being told. And the idea of examining mutant powers through the lens of mental health.
Yeah.
And if he can bring that level of intelligence where it's, if it's anyone else who's like, I'm going to downplay the Federation or the Federation's bad, but if it's someone that smart to be like, okay, I'm going to examine mutant powers through this lens,
yeah,
not through the lens of a teaching school, but through the lens of both, you have to be mentally strong to be able to manifest your powers, and that you also have to find a balance between everything. If he can bring that level of game to Trek, I am totally down for it.
The thing is, as well, we've obviously just watched the movies as well. We've already seen the Briar Patch being a thing with the Federation already being on shaky ground with that kind of stuff. So I don't mind the idea of having like these grey areas where the Federation have done stuff that's like, well, from one point of view, it's not great, but from the Federation's point of view, this gains them an upper hand or against something else. I just do not want to see another Section 31 conspiracy movie. We've seen too many of like, oh my god, there's a secret thing in the Federation, they're going to take it out. We don't need that. I like gray areas. We like to see something going on there. But yeah, so that would be the way to do it. Yeah.
So we're finished the first season of Lower Decks. It has not been showing in England, in the UK. Yep. So our dear friend Aid has not been able to watch it, which is a crime because it's surprisingly good. Like, I was really skeptical when it first came out, when I first heard about it. I thought that it would be making fun of Star Trek, but in our last episode, we did kind of a bonus episode a little ways ago, talking about Lower Decks, and we mostly agreed that it was a pretty positive embrace of the nerdiness of Star Trek, that the characters all loved Starfleet, they just all loved something different about Starfleet, and that's kind of, to me, I saw that as a metaphor for Star Trek fans in general, who, those of you that have been longtime Space Force fans, you know that I've slowly come around to this this idea that there is no one Star Trek, that everybody has their own Star Trek. And those ideas of what Star Trek is are often very, very different. And if you tried to make a Venn diagram of my Star Treks, there is nowhere in which all of those diagrams overlap. There is no central sweet spot which we can hit that will please everybody and make everybody's Star Trek, hit everybody's Star Trek buttons. And I kind of see the four Lower Deck members on the Cerritos as representative of that, right? Like, you know, they all kind of love Starfleet in their own way. But anyway, that's wrapped up with some pretty high level cameos from Riker and Troy. And I love the fact that the ship was called the Solvang. Solvang is this little tourist town in the middle of California, which I have very fond memories of. For those of you that don't know it, it's a like a Danish themed town,
mm-hmm.
With lots of Danish food and a theater and art and wine and stuff. It's a little tourist town, and I used to drive to Solvang with my family every year and take vacations there. In fact, for the Ars Magica fans in the audience, when Ars Magica held conventions in the United States, they were held at Solvang. That was where Grand Tribunal US was held. So the fact that ship was in the Solvang just made me laugh, but it was a pretty great season, I thought, and a lot of fun. And it ended with Boimler being transferred off the ship, which is, you know, a shock to our system. Jim, what did you think of Lower Decks?
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely full throated. There was one episode in there that I walked away from it. I'm like, I don't like that. I don't like that.
Is it trouble with Boimler?
No, actually, it was the Moist Vessel episode.
Oh, okay.
So in the episode, they have Marinel's Starfleet Academy roommate show up, and she's a captain. And it shows that by this point, Marinel could have been a captain. And she's just thrown that away. And instead of, and the whole episode, she's self-sabotaging, but it's impacting the rest of the crew.
Right.
Like there was a thing about self-sabotage, like you can do that as a character trait, but once it starts impacting other people, that's when you're a problem.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like that episode, like I loved Marinel up until that episode, and that episode should have took some of the polish off of it. But for the whole season, when they did the holodeck episode where it was the movie send-off, and they had the James Horner music, and they had the lens flails, and they had all the little tropes of Star Trek movies in there.
Yeah.
You know, the big old ship, the nemesis plot, the revenge, the self-destruct, like all the little Easter eggs. I'm like, I'm so glad that we did that whole season of sitting through every single one of those films, because it wasn't just a love letter to the TOS movies or the Next Generation movies or the Kelvin. It was the whole spectrum.
Yeah.
Everything was represented in some way. And then the final episode, they do their Star Trek movie. Like they did a send-up of Star Trek movies, and this one opens up a ship is destroyed in the first 2 seconds of the episode. They do a couple callbacks to like Landru and the Return of the Archons, and you know Festival, the Red Owl, and I kind of love all that stuff. But it was not just there for a joking reference. It's there to be like, hey, Starfleet has this track record of meeting new people, helping them out, and then leaving them alone.
Yeah, that was a really recurring trope in that episode. And this is exactly Khan's complaint, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your captain never bothered to check on our progress. Like, this is exactly what the show is about. Yeah.
And just the fact that the whole episode is centered on this idea of the Packlet's World joke. I've made the joke, Packlet, make it go on this podcast.
Yeah.
A joke, and they told them into a reasonable threat based on they scavenge things. They have a whole bunch of stuff they don't understand, and they've smashed it together. Like every time a starship shows up, they're like, "Ha ha, Enterprise!" They're not overly intelligent. They haven't evolved that way. They just happen to be a kid with a gun.
Yeah.
So I really liked the season. I thought Lower Decks. Is an interesting mixture of Star Trek zaniness and humor that is indicative of classic TOS more so than say the Bowman era.
Sure.
But yes, to your point, there is a cognitive dissonance that goes through even my head when I'm like, okay, this Riker is supposed to be the same Riker that shows up in Picard.
Yeah.
But they haven't had the kid yet.
Yeah.
But I do kind of like that Riker story has sort of been a guy who was really uptight when we first meet him, and he slowly over time just loosens the fuck up.
I love
to realize that his calm, cool self is not an act; it's just who he is over the progression of time and different iterations. I kind of love that.
And we got some great interactions with Riker, Troy, and the other members of the bridge crew. The Titan shows up, and that's a big deal.
Just posted the whole Twitter thread.
That's right.
Hey guys, if you don't know, this is a book contest.
Tell us the story behind the design of the Titan.
Okay, so I'm not going to be able to say his name. It's like Sean Trigaro or something like that.
Okay.
I really apologize for that. So essentially what happened was...
Follow Jim on Twitter for the details. Go on.
Was Pocket Books was doing a new line of series called Star Trek Titan.
Yeah.
And it was just going to follow Riker and Troy, pick up back with Nemesis.
Yeah.
They had great success with the relaunch of Deep Space Nine with their season 8. They've done it with Enterprise. So they were going to do it with Next Generation in terms of having the Picard storyline continue in Next Generation novels and have the Riker storyline continue in his collection of novels. They published 3 of them, but they hadn't shown a picture of the ship. And all the fan letters were like, we want to see the Titan. Show us the Titan.
Yeah.
What does the Titan look like? So Pocket Books came out with a contest, and a fan could submit a design for the Titan. Okay. And it would be approved not only by Pocket Book editors, because they had to approve it, but also be approved by Michael and Denise Okuda from all the production from Star Trek V onward through Next Generation and all of Bowman Trek.
Yeah.
Plus a couple other ship designers. They would get final approval. And this guy submitted his design. It got approved. Paramount commissioned a small miniaturized shooting model with lights. And I saw this thing in person because it wasn't just that they filmed something with it. It was you sit in this room. It was part of the Star Trek tour. So you sat in this darkened theater, and I sat on it the first day of their exhibit, which was on the Queen Mary. We sat in this darkened theater, and there was a 4-minute video, and Wesley's there, and Tuvok's there. I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like Tuvok's the first officer in the books, so they acknowledge that bit of continuity. And then the ship shows up, like it literally comes out of the floor, like the floor opens up and it hero music. And I'm like, that's a cool way to introduce your ship. Like that's you know, that's going to stick with me. So they did that. It showed up in Star Trek Online, which I didn't know because I don't play that game.
Right.
So it shows up on online, and Eagle Moss, the company that produces those miniaturized stall ships, which I have a few, I didn't know this until I was doing my research for my thread. They did a Luna class Titan too.
Nice.
But we've never seen it on any of the official movies. We've never seen it in any of the official shows until that Next Gen music hits.
That's right.
Riker shows up and he shouts Redolent.
Yeah.
And like that just there was a fan service element to Lower Decks. Well, it's mentioning things, and it mentions things that aren't in continuity and brings them into continuity, like the Spock helmet is now official part of canon. And that's fun. But I think the underlying message of Lower Decks is that they understand why we are fans of Star Trek. And it's not just the winking and nodding Family Guy humor. It's that those, like you say, it's an interpretation of all of Trek.
Yeah.
It touches a little here, a little there. It's just taking these pinches and it's trying to tell a story from a different perspective. And I think that that's what Discovery does. That's what Picard does. It's taking this formula of Captain POV, and it's like, okay, now we're going to show you the ensigns.
Yeah.
In Discovery, it's we're going to show you the XO. And in Picard, we're going to show you what's life after being a captain. We've never seen that.
I definitely think that this seems to be CBS's strategy. Now that Discovery has been successful and they've realized that if we don't have some Star Trek going on every week of the year, people will quit our service. So they have a content need. Well, how do we hit that content? And the answer is lots of different Star Trek shows, which are all very different from each other, like kind of give them all their own niche, right? And with the announcement, The Strange New Worlds coming out with the return of Captain Pike and Number One and Young Spock, yeah. Which is kind of a flashback to the TOS style of episodes with sort of Planet of the Week. And that's a strong contrast to Picard that's got this like big overarching plot line. And Discovery, which to me feels like it's scratching that cinematic itch. Like it's very much like a movie divided up into 1 hour episodes, you know.
So you also mentioned, Jim.
Yeah.
That this introduces elements to the Star Trek canon. Now, I cannot see Lower Decks as Star Trek canon because it is that Family Guy humor stuff. It's so far removed from Next Generation. It's just like, this is a parallel universe thing. If stuff pops up later on they mention that was on Lower Decks, that's just a coincidence. It's not because it was established in the canon. It just niggles me so much. Like, as I mentioned on before in the podcast, I really wish this was an adventure animated series like the classic animated series. The idea that it is a Rick and Morty Family Guy stuff, it just really turns me off of it completely. I just cannot do it.
This is the second time I've had this conversation this week because, you know, I talk Star Trek outside of the podcast. and the way I sold it to my friend, and he's dyed-in-wool classic, like he was a young man when the original series was showing up. He's very like Trekkle, not Trekkie kind of guy. I said, here's how I rationalize the zaniness and the tongue-in-cheek qualities of the show, is that this is Q's interpretation of what Star Trek people are supposed to, like what they pretend to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is just a little, like these adventures happen, these stories happen, they just don't happen to the exaggeratedness of the animated format.
Yeah.
And I think I was able to sell him on that. And the fact that Q does show up and then get told, you know, fuck off Q, it's just kind of brilliant.
The surprising thing to me about Lower Decks, as I was watching it, is that it's actually also a pretty great action show. Like the characters get in action in fights and tense conflict and starship battles. And I mean, they fight like this whole Paklin fleet in the latest episode. And it's actually pretty great. There's some very cinematic, tense action-adventure shots when the Bajoran security chief commandeers a shuttle and flies it across so that the engineering guy, what's his name with the implant?
That's Rutherford.
Yeah, with Rutherford. So he can take Rutherford over to defeat the Pathless by planting a virus in their ship, which is like, you know, Independence Day and classic sci-fi all over again. But you know, that scene's pretty great action-wise. Like, I would totally game that scene. And I could see the players that were in it just having a blast. Certainly the Bajoran security chief was having a blast.
This is the best day of my life.
Anyway, now Lower Decks is taking a break, and we can all get ready for the third season of Discovery. Now, the show has made a huge jump, both literally and metaphorically. It was known when it was first created, Discovery was the series that was set in the past. And a lot of fans, including some of our audience members, have been kind of confused about Star Trek's obsession with mining the past instead of going forward in the future. And until we got Picard, this seemed like some kind of weird unbreakable rule that Star Trek just never went forward beyond Nemesis or beyond what we knew about from the Kelvinverse, the destruction of Romulus and the death of Spock and all that business. So we spent two seasons of that. We spent two seasons of sort of mucking around in the shady parts of the TOS canon, trying to find a way to do our own story without doing anything that was obviously going to break what we knew. But the end of season two makes it pretty clear, at least to me as an audience member, that the makers of Discovery always knew they were never going to stay in the past. They were going to come up with some reason, some big bad menace in the past that was such a big deal that after Discovery handled it, the entire thing was sworn to secrecy, including the very existence of Discovery. And in so doing, they explain why we've never heard of any of these things before. Why have we never heard of the Spore Drive? Why has Spock never mentioned his sister? And I needed no more explanation for that fact than Jim's wonderful explanation that, like, Spock doesn't talk about his family. Like, this is canon, right? So I was totally fine with that. But the whole rest of that business about we're going to jump 900 plus years into the future and the threat of control is so great that we're never going to talk about anything that ever associated with Discovery ever again. All of its crew, all of its people, the ship itself, the technology, the events in which it was in are all need to know basis, and nobody except the audience needs to know. And we make this jump. We leave the past and we jump 930 years, I think, right? They said, yeah, into the future. And now it finally does sort of live up to its name. It really is Discovery. Right now we have a whole new galaxy out there. We don't know anything about. And they have a clean palette and they can kind of do whatever they want. Now, there are some Star Trek scenes that are set in the future, like Calypso and a few others. So they have to make sure that they don't invalidate any of that stuff. But that's a much easier lift than trying to write two seasons of a show set in the TOS era without killing Captain Pike, right? So anyway, Jim, where are we at with Discovery? Like, what are your thoughts on where the show is now? And without looking forward yet, we'll do that in a minute. But looking backwards, what do you think?
So this is where I deliver all my teas that I put on Twitter yesterday. Okay. You made the comment in our last show, you know, is this a golden age of Star Trek? And I was hesitant. I didn't want to embrace that. Having rewatched all of seasons one and two of Discovery in the last 2 weeks and finding myself really enjoying it and accepting it not as the show that I want it to be.
Okay.
Because I don't want to do a war story in Star Trek. I think that's been done, and that was done really well in Deep Space Nine, and I don't necessarily know if we need to remind that particular era. But I was able to accept the show for what it is. And I don't mean that as damning praise, because what the show does really well, maybe the plots are a little hokey. Like, there was a moment in the season finale of season two, will go flying around Bolnum, and she's doing the full Iron Man, and they're using the language of superhero comics.
Can we put a pin in that and come back to the superhero-ness of that episode?
Oh, we can totally put a pin on that.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And my wife turned to me and said, "This is hokey." And I'm like, "This is hokey." But then they give us a scene where Stamets and Coble all together in the sick bay. And when they do emotional beats, they land those emotional beats. The character moments and Sonequa Martin-Green as just a national treasure. And whole performance, like even delivering some of the most problematic content with Ash Tyler's character in season one, I believe it because I believe Hole. If I don't believe anything else in the show, I believe in Hole to be able to deliver performances that are just magnificent. Like that scene where she's told that Hole mother's alive and she is given 35 seconds to go through the five stages of grief.
Right.
And she acts all of them out. And it's just so human, yet twinged with this little disconnect of Vulcan-ness. She's just amazing. And being able to accept it, like, okay, we'll didn't do a little story. We're going to do mailed images, you know. And sometimes the plots don't work. But what works in every episode is the character beats because the actors are just so good. Like, there's not a bad actor in the bunch.
That's right.
Yeah. I like the show. I stuck with it all through season one. Season two, I think, was a massive improvement on season one. The issues I had with season one is when we started this off, no one knew if this was a reboot, this was a continuation. Everyone was going, what is it? And no one would acknowledge that fact. Because no one wanted to kind of pigeonhole it into something. Now, whether or not that was because they thought, well, if we screw up here, we accidentally erase something for continuity. It's an alternate universe. If we stick with it and it goes well, we can insert it in. And I think that there was some unnecessary choices to the actual show which don't reflect into TOS. Which, if you go by the theory, obviously, like we've said before about the idea that the Borg thing in First Contact alter timeline slightly, that's okay. But like the idea that you've got the holographic communicators between the ships, and that gets removed, and they never mention that again. You're thinking, well, they're never that for the Next Generation, so it just seems unnecessary. Why could they not just talk to each other on the screens like they did in the classic Trek? There's no need to have it, and it wouldn't have been an issue then. So it just seems there's the stuff, ideas that they came up with that seem to have kind of like jarred against what needed to be, could have been, still been done and not cause a problem. And they said, oh, no, go ahead anyway. And so there's that. The other thing I had, again, with Fundamental Against, first everyone mentioned it, why the hell did they have to redesign the Klingons? It seems to be literally the guy, whoever designs the costumes, seems to somehow manage to get the job to do the Klingons as well. So it's like, well, of course, Klingons are costumes as well, aren't they? Surely. Do I get to design? And again, an unnecessary thing they didn't do, because these people should have been instantly recognizable. You wanted to know they were the Klingons. You wanted to switch on. That should be your selling point. Oh my God, it's the Klingons. Okay, that's great. Now, who are these guys? Are they Klingons or are they something else? Yeah. And that seemed like, again, another odd choice, because you're creating a barrier against getting people that have watched the original series to watch your series for no good reason. There was no need to do it.
And then they walk all that back, right? Like they give them hair.
Season two. That's right. Exactly. That's what I mean. And this is why season two kind of improved, because I think like these kind of blocks that were just kind of creating a barrier, they realized, crap, this is actually what we're doing. We are creating an issue with this series to not appeal to the individual, because we are doing something for no reason, no good reason at all. It's kind of, as you, even though you were saying, like, Spock never talks about his family.
Yeah.
The Burnham Spock connection, again, isn't entirely necessary to the plot. You see some stuff of Sarek in season one. But there's nothing else in it. It becomes at least a plot point in season two. But even then, you could still follow season one and two's plot without her being a relative to Spock. And it just seems, again, it's almost as, you know, again, it's like, oh, I've got great ideas. We've got another another unseen Spock relative, like they did in that movie. Remember that movie they did where he had his brother? It's like, it just said, why did you do it? There's just puzzling elements in it. And I can also see why people are expecting to see Next Generation style or original series stuff where we get a problem to solve, 45 minutes, it's solved, we move on.
Yeah.
This was a single character narrative show. If Burnham did not interact with that character virtually got no mention at all.
Right.
The bridge crew, the bridge crew, I don't think actually get names and identities until season two. The doctor and Stamets and the doctor, they don't get a plot point. This is why season two is so much better, because I'm actually realized, crap, we've actually created characters that people actually would give a shit about if we actually did something with them.
Yeah.
So the idea that they're actually building it, I mean, Tilly and all this, I mean, we had the fundamental thing with the cyborg character being taken over by the Section 31 stuff. If they were just like Crewman Z or whatever, they actually had names and background, but they wasted an entire season where they could have had a season's worth of these characters' backstories grow over. So by the time we got to characters dying, characters changing their way of doing stuff, they would have more impact, because we literally got an episode or two of introduction. So like, well, they've only been around for 45 minutes. Why do I give a crap if they die or not? And I think that was the problem. I think they were so transfixed in giving Burnham this single character vision, and that was all they were trying to do. And I think that was a shame. But fundamentally, I think it's going to get better. I think I'm concerned that removing Discovery from the Star Trek universe, because you're now into the far future, you're going to lose some of that stuff, and it's kind of like, almost like the Voyager problem, where it's like, hey, I've got a great idea, we send them away from Starfleet, never get, and then it's like, well, yeah, but who do they talk to then? Who do they get their orders from? Who do they get their missions from? And it's going to be a plodding thing where they're just doing stuff off their own backs. But
I think that your observation that it's like Voyager is quite frankly pretty accurate. I think that. You know, Jim, you said, I don't know if we needed another war story because we got that from DS9. I don't know if we needed more TOS Enterprise stories, but there's Captain Pike. Like, I think the show was very explicitly mining the genres of other Star Trek shows. I think it had a DS9 phase, it had a TOS phase, and now it's entering a Voyager phase.
And I don't mind strangely, sorry, go on.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't mind Strange New Worlds having a... I hope Strange New Worlds does do that kind of one-and-done storyline where you solve a problem. If they have an overarching thing that goes through it as well, fantastic. But I think that's another way to win back your old viewers. By saying, hey, look, this is just like the original series. This is just like Next Generation. There is stuff going on that we refer to. But generally speaking, there'll be a problem presented. We will solve the problem. That's it. And again, I'm really hoping if they've already spoken about some of the other cast on Strange New Worlds, I'm hoping those characters are going to get some screen time. I absolutely love Pike. I like new Spock. But I would like to see other characters I give a shit about. I want to see that next Data or Doctor character show up and go, oh my God, I did not expect that character to be the character of Strange New Worlds after seeing Pike. And I'm hoping they do something with that.
Yeah.
Jim? So I think with season one of Discovery.
Yeah.
Season one of Discovery is coming out and it's trying to find Star Trek's place in a Game of Thrones dominated landscape.
Yeah.
I think that's the biggest struggle, especially the first half of Discovery, of trying to identify where it fits within the milieu of current popular entertainment.
Yeah.
So much so that when they were licensing the toys to McFarlane Toys, because they got the contract, they were like, oh yeah, totally make an action figure of Takuvma. He's going to be the next breakout star of all Star Trek show. So they saw it drawing up designs and they had a mock-up of Takuvma. And then they killed him off in the second episode.
Yeah.
And Fallen Toys is like, what the hell is this? They almost got into a contract dispute. Because if you know anything about Todd McFarlane, you know he's a guy who wants to fight. Yeah. And he's like, why are we wasting resources on a character who's dead? So I think it's a lot of that is the shock value. It was killing off the captain, blowing up the ship in the first two episodes, giving you a Star Trek-like show, but like trying to say, okay, we're going to have sex in it. We're going to have death in it. And it's going to matter.
Yeah.
And not quite being able to stick the landing because of the pre-production stuff. Like Brian Fuller was fired after the first two episodes.
Right.
So he's gone. The show was oval budget. They couldn't quite agree on what the show was going to be, because Fogel's original idea was that Star Trek Discovery was going to be like American Horror Story. Well, each season is a brand new show on a brand new ship with a brand new plot.
Yeah.
So they weren't going to be continuing Bonham's story beyond what the initial story was. And they may have recasted everyone into new roles, which would have been weird. But I could see it. I could see it being pulled off, but it would have been cost productive, you know, cost prohibitive, because then you're building whole new starship sets. So I think Discovery has that problem in season one, where it's like, we don't quite know what Star Trek means in a landscape where Game of Thrones is all anyone wants from genre fiction, or seemingly what anyone is willing to make in genre fiction.
Yeah.
I also think that one of the difficulties, and one of the reasons why I was hesitant to say this is a golden age of Trek, is because the fan base has become so niche.
Right.
Only because we're on a subscription model basis. There's a paywall. If you want Star Trek, you can come to Star Trek. But the way people are being introduced to Star Trek now is through friends. Like me going, hey, I know you're not paying for CBS All Access. Come on over and we'll sit on the couch and we'll watch Star Trek. Well, I can only do that with like five people.
Yeah. Right?
And then I'm done. That's my whole decks of people. Whereas original Bowman era Trek was on like regular syndicated television, you know, Channel 13. Like everyone got Channel 13, everyone got Star Trek. So if you wanted to engage, you could. And that was one of my initial hesitant things. I'm a little less concerned about that because, like you pointed out, Star Trek Prodigy is coming to Nickelodeon.
Yep.
And yes, that's still basic cable, but that's a much larger area than a paid subscription.
It's also a new audience, right? It's specifically getting a new generation of people interested in Star Trek.
I think Star Trek should do that. Like, I think Star Trek needs to be able to be like, hey, kids, here's Star Trek. Star Trek's fun.
Speaking as the producers, it's intellectual property maintenance, right? Like if we don't get a new generation hooked on Star Trek, we're going to be fighting older and older Star Trek fans forever. And we've seen what that's done to comic books, right? Like that's a bad problem to get into. Yeah, exactly.
But this is the thing as well, because hasn't Discovery now shifted to a mainstream TV channel in the US? Is it no longer on All Access? Is it on something else now?
They just ailed, in preparation for the new season, they just aired all of season one on CBS on like a Saturday.
But that's a regular channel.
The regular channel here is channel two. They're floating with the idea, but I'm just imagining the casual non-internet fan.
Yeah, this is it. Because I think in the UK, we've just had the Discovery. I don't know if we had season one or season two, but I think they had it on a regular TV channel rather than one that is beyond, like Netflix or Amazon or whatever. So, but unfortunately, it was on, I think it was E4, which means it was literally tucked away at the one of those, you know, almost like, it was not Channel 4. This is one of our five other channels and we'll chuck it on that. Used to be on BBC Two, Next Generation, and Classic Trek, which obviously was, 6 o'clock or whatever it used to be, BBC Two, it was a big channel then, so it's. Yeah. I don't know if anyone ever saw it, but at least it was out there. And I think that's the thing. I think if you're not able to show it to the general public at large and say, "Hey, this is actually worth your time," without having to front up £15, they are going to struggle. And this is the thing.
Now, John Rogers, who's the a screenwriter and creator of comics and games and television. He's got a little post-it note on his inspiration board that he's had up for a couple of years now that says, you are now in the miniseries business. And this is a very hard lesson he had to learn, very painful lesson, based on the fact that that we're no longer making network television shows that go on for 7, 10, 15 years anymore. Now we're making shows that last a season or two or three, and they get canceled after three seasons. And it's a shame, but that's the way that the market is right now. And so Rogers posted this to remind himself not to make a show that he wanted to do for 10 years, but But to make a show that he could tell that story in two or three seasons and be content. Is this Discovery's fate? Is the third season of Discovery the last season of Discovery? We talked about this with the movies. Like, every movie was the last Star Trek movie until the next one got made.
I don't think so. And here's why I don't think so.
Yeah.
So I just talked about, I just talked trash on the paywall. And I still think it's a problem. I understand that the cost of producing a show of this quality with this level of special effects and this level of writing and this level of acting, regular TV cannot support that with ads. I understand that that's just something I have to live with. My supposition on to your point is, I think with season two, they figured it out. Season two, yes, those the same story, those the same miniseries quality, but season two and season one are drastically different animals. They're doing different stories. Like, to your point, though, one's a more of a DS9 approach and one's a TOS approach, right down to using as much of the original music as possible, right down to using clips from the cage. And even setting up their last shot so that the camera pans out of the bridge dome in the way that the camera panned into the bridge dome on the cage to bookend that story. And with this new iteration of Discovery being so far from the future, I think we'll have a season here, which is going to be a season long. And who knows if we continue on from this point forward in this new time frame, or if we go somewhere else, if we go into another universe. And I think they're going to continually reinvent what it means to discover things. So I think the full season of Discovery, if I'm being charitable, is like the discovery of you versus the other. It's you and self. It's Avok struggling with Ash Tylor and Ash and Bonham struggling with whole hatred of Klingons. And season two, it's the discovery of, like, does faith have a role in it? Like, where is religion in Star Trek? Like, the end of the whole predication of the season is Bonham has to take a logical leap of faith.
Right.
And just to get to that point, the number of sort of mental hoops that they have to jump through to get Bonham to that headspace to have Spock say it's only logical, and then do it and have it be the successful thing. I think they figured out a way to keep this show going on for maybe 3, 4, 5 years, but each story is going to be a book. It's going to be a graphic novel on your bookshelf. It's not going to be the way a normal Star Trek show is constructed.
Not be funny. Religion in Star Trek is a bit cooler than regular everyday religion. I mean, you get the Bajoran orbs that can control stuff. You get Klingon monks that control time. Slightly more interesting than, having Christmas Day or something. Yeah, I say, hey, look at me, I can control time. So there is that kind of magic power element to it. So that's quite interesting. But
that's sci-fi fantasy. Your god is actually an entity that can do.
Of course, exactly. It can't just be a belief system. There's actually something out there that can actually send you magic spells, effectively.
She's literally an angel.
Well, yeah.
She's fiery. She's showing up and she's helping people. Like, it's a little on the nose.
Yeah. I don't honestly know if this is going to be it. So three seasons. We got four Enterprise seasons. I think they would like to match Enterprise if they could, because I think they want to be the trailing season, contenders. Like, oh, we've only got three. I think the idea you can get seven seasons out of DS9, seven seasons out of Next Gen, and then only four out of Enterprise, and then match four would be what they want to aim for. It really depends on what they are attempting to achieve with season three. Are they attempting to just basically blunder through and just go, oh, we're in the future now, we're 900 years ago, we're just going to move from planet to planet and do good? Or are they going to do something with establishing a new federation? Are we going to see something else like that? If they do that, then obviously that can branch out to a gazillion different ideas of storylines. But it really does depend on what the actual episodes come down to, what the actual main kind of plot is going on there. Again, it's the other thing. Obviously, the other thing being is with Strange New Worlds coming along, is that that is technically a Discovery spin-off. They could almost say, well, that's season four of Discovery there. That's what do you mean? It's just called something different, but it is season four because it's a spin-off of Discovery. So I don't know. I'm concerned about that. This is so far removed from the kind of like the whole set Starfleet Federation stuff that it's going to be to a dead end. And same as Picard. If season two, I cannot see that going much more than two or three seasons either, because I think that's the same problem. I think you're going to, every time you take a step away from the core Star Trek way of doing things, you kind of cut off another avenue of storytelling that you could have used previously, kind of thing. So
I think Picard has a shorter self life on it than Discovery does, only because of the age of Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Like I can see, like, I think the producers are wise enough and small enough to be like, maybe we get three seasons out of Patrick. One more, you know, it's the last go around. Let's do everything we can with those seasons and tell a story with the beginning, middle, and end.
Exactly. This is not a problem, because I mentioned this on numerous podcasts. I would rather see a TV series that knows when to stop than drill it into the ground and say, well, yeah, season five was the best. By the time I got to season nine, it's absolutely shite. I would like to see a three-act story for Picard. We get three seasons, they do what they need to do, and it's done. Everyone goes, well, that was actually really good. Same as Discovery, same thing. If they keep just pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, it's just gonna ruin itself. It's gonna be, you know, it's just gonna get to that thing. Well, you know, it wasn't great. It wasn't as good as series two. We never got that pike back, did we? You know.
So I want to go back to that idea that Jim noted about the climax to Discovery, in which is using a lot of superhero cinematic language, and I noticed it too. Yeah, as I was watching it again with them assembling the suit, like the super suit is more of a cinematic, gets more emphasis in the movies than it does in the comics. In the comics, people have a costume and they worry a lot about what the costume looks like, and they spend a lot of time making it. But once you've done it, it's kind of ignored. But the cinematic superheroes have made the super suit into a suit of armor, and it's specifically armor. And I think we owe a lot of this to Iron Man, but also just the technology of how superheroes movies get made. And so as they're assembling the suit, and then she's sort of there, she has that moment where she's staring at the suit and the suit sort of looking back at her, you know, before she puts it on, then she turns around and the suit kind of almost voluntarily puts itself onto her. And this idea of giving the suit a kind of its own identity, that when she puts on the suit, yeah, she's her, but she's also the Red Angel. And there's even that moment where Spock says, it's your mother and it's you, right? So it's like this weird other identity. It's her secret identity as the Red Angel. And it's got wings, like you noted, and it's got the color scheme, and she's flying through space in it. And that was a superhero movie, at least for part of it. Maybe not all of it, but there was a lot of superhero language.
Discovery has been using them.
Yeah.
It's not surprising that Star Trek is, like, season one of Discovery is, it's this weird mashup of, we're going to be trying to find our place in Game of Thrones, but also we have to find our place in the superhero genre.
Yeah.
Like, there was that episode where Bona, like the third episode, when they introduced Lorca and his context is King.
Yeah.
Bonham is running around corridors. She's being chased by a monster. She has to jump in perfectly, land. She does the superhero pose landing perfectly into a moving shuttlecraft that's hovering right before a blast off. Like, yeah. The show is reliant on superhero visual shorthand. The first episode of season two, it's the, I have to catch Captain Pike before he lands on the spikes.
Yeah.
It's the Lois Lane, Superman has to save you from before you hit the ground.
Yeah.
Right down to the, we are just above the spikes.
Right, naturally, yeah. I've got you. Who's got you? Yeah. Well, I Rogers's point about shows only lasting three seasons has got nothing to do with the quality of the show.
Yeah.
It's all about the mechanics of the production, that now the cable companies don't need 100 episodes for syndication anymore. And so very, very good shows
shows that are going full steam and could easily keep going and maybe even get better get canceled after three seasons because the network, the cable channel, has enough, the streaming show has enough episodes now that and they can move on to something else.
Yeah, Netflix cancels shows after two seasons.
Yeah, yeah.
We're already seeing a pushback of that. We're seeing fans have gotten wise to this. They invest time and energy into a show and passion. Like, fans are passionate. Like, you're already paying for a subscription model to be in here. Like, there's no reason we should not have Daredevil season four.
Well, it's never going to happen.
It's never going to happen. No. There's no reason that should happen. There's no reason that those really good Netflix original shows that just get the you've had three seasons and you're done.
Okay, since you brought it up, the third season of Daredevil was so goddamn good.
Yes, exactly my point. That's my point. Daredevil only got better with time. Yes, they have a kind of a sophomore slump in season two when they can't really quite figure out what the show is in relation to Defenders. But once they got Defenders out of the way and they were its own show again, That show is kicking.
Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I don't mind the idea. I think everyone, they're always on the lookout for a new IP. That's all they're worried about. They are literally scared of running stuff into the ground, and they want something new and fresh every time. It's another comic analogy. It's those Marvels launching them issue ones every couple of months because they need that boost. They need that thing. You know, Star Trek Discovery. Well, I've seen that. That came out 2 years ago. Oh, yeah, but you've not had a Star Trek Prodigy. Ah, that's new. It's like, okay, watch that. And I think this is the thing. I think if they've got these plans that are going up to 2027, I cannot believe that every single one of these shows is going to be a winner. There is at least going to be at least one or two duds. I cannot believe there's going to be, not necessarily the most abysmal thing you've ever seen, but, it's okay, but I wish it was a bit better than this. I mean, I'm not the greatest Voyager fan. I didn't see that all the way through from like past season four till way into it.
Yeah.
That compared to Next Generation, where I would be glued to the set every single episode every week, there's always going to be a thing. But like you said before, that one of those shows is going to be someone's favorite. So it's not as though it's going to be a bad show, but I think they're going to do this scattergun approach and just go, right, we're going to tweak this a little bit. It's going to be like this, but we're going to do this differently. And it's going to get on some people's nerves, and some people it's just going to be their favorite thing ever.
All right, so what do we hope to see? What do we want from the third season of Discovery? Now, we've been teased a little bit. We've gotten trailers. We've even got the first whole scene.
I have not seen it.
Yeah. I've avoided it.
But we've been teased a little bit. This idea of the Federation apparently no longer exists. People remember it. They know what it used to be, but it's not around anymore. And the galaxy took a hard left at this thing called the Burn. We have theories about what the Burn is. Jim?
So here's my theory, and it's
the Omega molecule theory, right?
What was that?
This is the Omega molecule theory.
This is the Omega particle theory. Yes.
Particle, yeah.
So in the episode of Voyager, let me rewind. There was a TNG episode called Forces of Nature. It's in season seven, and they find out that warp drive is destroying space. The very act of traveling faster than life is having an effect that's impacting this one planet of people, and it's going to spread throughout the universe. Eventually, it'll take all creation. Right? And in this episode, they put speed limits. Like, the Enterprise can't travel over warp 5 unless it's an emergency. And they never mention it again.
Nope.
Now, to the Voyager point, Voyager introduces a molecule that's the perfect God complex. Like, it's essentially the God element for the Borg. And in this episode, if an Omega molecule is destabilized, and Starfleet has a standing order, if a captain encounters it, immediately kill on sight. No negotiations, kill on sight. Because if it goes, warp drive is done. I'm thinking that the reason why the Federation doesn't exist is that these two elements have combined. We no longer have warp drive, and suddenly Discovery is the only ship that can travel faster than light. Because the metaphor, sense force contact, Yeah. Both Donald has been, if you can travel faster than life, that is what unites humanity.
Yeah.
That is what brings us together. That is what brings aliens together. And if you take it away, that's your apocalyptic moment.
Well, okay. That's a pretty standard element of science fiction. Like, you can't have an interstellar empire without faster than light travel.
Also, that would gel up quite well with Calypso, because Calypso, even when they get the shuttlecraft, the ship mentions to the guy that it's going to take so long, and he doesn't say, so what do you mean? Stop, you're not going warp 9? So it's like there's no mention of that. So maybe that would be sensible, and it would be a bloody good reason why it would fall apart, because if you cannot administer from ship to ship, I mean, I'd say again, I mentioned before, I play Traveller, the RPG, and the communication that literally goes from system to system. You can only go as fast as the ships go. Information only travels that fast. Something happens on one side of space, doesn't get to the other space till 9 months later. That would be at least some sensible reason why it all comes toughened down without having a shitty Section 31 conspiracy theory going on as well. But so I'd be really happy with that.
Well, interestingly, I was disappointed in one thing about season 3 Discovery. They brought Giorgio along. Now, I love the actress. Michelle Yeoh, it can do no wrong. But the evil Empress Michelle Yeoh has never been my favorite character on this show. And I wish that they had left her behind in the 22nd, 23rd century? 24th. I don't think you have to worry about a Section 31 plot. In fact, it seems like the first problem that the ship's got to do, they just got to get it up and flying again. Because, of course, the first thing it does is crash, right? So they have to get it fixed and flying, and then it's kind of rebuilding everything. I think, to me, Discovery has been trying to answer this question from the very first episodes of what is Star Trek? What is Star Trek? And by that, they usually ask, what is Starfleet? And Burnham's always the person who's been kind of the flying the flag and the person who epitomizes what Starfleet is. And she hasn't always gotten it right, but she's always been asking the right questions. And I have a higher opinion of season one than I think you guys do. I liked it quite a bit. But then we get season two, and Pike becomes kind of the role model character. But, you know, he comes to the relationship between Spock and Burnham is key. And I disagree with you, Abe, this idea that Burnham's relationship to Spock could be edited out of the entire plot. I really don't think it can. But I don't think that's why they did it. I think they did it for the simple reason that, as you said, you want to create characters people give a shit about. So they, from the money side, the production angle comes in and says, well, no one's going to care about this character unless we can give them a connection to somebody. Like, they have to be somebody's cousin, brother, wife.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's like, this is Captain Kirk's great uncle.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's also Star Trek precedent. Like, in every pilot, there was a character from a previous incarnation of Trek. Yeah. And Enterprise was the one that really cemented that when they're like, we just got Cromwell back for 5 minutes to do our speech.
Yeah.
You know, for Zephyr Cochrane. But Voyager had Quark. And Deep Space Nine had Picard, and TNG had Bones.
Yeah.
Like, so if you have to keep the lineage, who better to use than Sarek?
Yeah.
Well, so anyway, season three now is a test. If we have spent the first couple of seasons figuring out what is Starfleet, what do we really stand for? What do we represent? And that big moral quandary really happens, I think, at the end of the first season of Discovery, when, you know, Giorgio wants to blow up the Klingon moon, and Burnham's like, we can't do that. Like, we're Starfleet. We're better than that. We're not going to resort to the explosive solution to all problems, right? And we stand up for what Starfleet means, and we fight, and we win, and we win based on our values, not because of our force. Yeah. Well, so now, and then we get season two, which has got great examples of that with Pike and Number One and everybody else kind of demonstrating what Starfleet is and demonstrating our values. Okay, well then what's the third stage? Well, now you have to put your values into practice on an empty slate. Now they know what Starfleet is. So they go into this brand new millennia where there is no Federation. And now they have to put their values into practice by rebuilding. And it feels kind of like Battlestar Galactica to me, like this kind of like,
you know, we're in a very bad situation. We have limited resources, but we're gonna, but it's a different answer to the Battlestar Galactica problem. And so we're gonna rebuild. It's a rebuilding story. And as a gamer, the rebuilding story is part of the post-apocalyptic genre. And this is a genre that I've never actually been very excited about for a long time. Like, I hated post-apocalyptic games because it was like, okay, give me another goddamn zombie apocalypse. Like, that's the last thing I ever want to see. But the great bit about a post-apocalypse games is the rebuilding. When you say, okay, well, we're going to rebuild our society, but we can make it better than it was. We can learn from our mistakes. We can build a new society that's got all the good shit that we had, and leave aside all the bad shit that we wish we didn't have, right? That we like to think we outgrew. And we can create a new federation that's the best of both worlds. And to, you know, to drop a Star Trek reference. And I would love to see that. And that's what I'm looking for in Star Trek, in Discovery Season 3, is creating a federation.
Right.
Waiting for that moment where Burnham and the captain, the alien guy, I can't remember, I forgot his name.
Saru.
Yeah, Saru. Who, by the way, I almost stopped liking in the middle of season two, but he won me back. When he and Saru and Tilly and the other characters are all together, and they said, we have to create the Federation over again, and I'm waiting for Burnham to say, we can make it better. We're not just going to make the Federation. We're going to make it better. And I can't wait for that moment. And that's the season that I want to see.
And this is precisely, I think, why Giorgio's in this series. She is the marquee of this series.
Yeah, you're right.
She's going to be the, hey, don't do it that way. This is bullshit. Yeah. We're going to do it my way. And then all you guys come with me. Don't listen to that. And then I think there's going to be, we're going to see some crew friction between them. They're going to peel off and do stuff.
She's going to be the devil on Burnham's shoulder, right?
Totally. Yeah.
So I have a wild fan theory as to why Joel Joe's here.
Okay.
We know that there's going to be a Trill this season.
Oh, yeah. We saw that in the trailer. Yeah.
So we know there's a Trill. In whole novel that just came out, I haven't read it yet, which is like Die Standing.
Okay.
It's Giorgio as Agent Giorgio in all timeline, and she's interacting with Enwene Dax, which is the Dax of the TOS era. Because that's the one who has the relationship with Bones. I'm supposing that this is not just a Trill, that this is a continuation of the Dax storyline, and that Giorgio is there because she's had experience with him.
Well, I have to say, if you're looking for a way to connect Discovery Season 3, 950 years in the future, with the Federation that we know, as a writer, I think, okay, well, who could still be alive? What characters could still be alive 1,000 years in the future? Who can we guest star? Dax is one of those characters.
And I just completely blanked at them because when you said Trill, I had in my head Tribble, and I could not figure out what the fucking hell you were talking about. It's like, what? There was a Tribble that had a relationship with Bones McCoy? What's going on with this?
the God Tribble, and that will be it's like this giant flying spaghetti monster.
But yeah, Dax would be better. And again, this would tie in. If they do not, if they put another Trill in it, it's not Dax.
Yeah.
You're missing an opportunity. It's crazy to do it.
I mean,
Dax was already 900 years old.
Exactly. Yeah.
See, you know, it reminds me like whenever Marvel does this, right? And they create like, you know, a what if or something, and the characters, the runaways all go to like a far future version of the 30th century in Marvel. And the writers are trying to figure out, okay, well, which Avengers can still be around? Okay, Thor's a god, he's still around. Vision's an android, he's still around. You know, and you start crossing off all the people that are mere mortals, right? Well, that's exactly what must have happened with like the Star Trek cast, right? You're like looking at all the characters, thinking, okay, who could still be alive 1,000 years in the future? Data. But Data got killed at the end of Picard.
Yep.
So Data can't be around. Dax is one of them. Q. Who else? Who's immortal in the Star Trek universe?
Well, there's the alien race at the end of the arena, the Metrons.
Well, but what like, named character? Who that we give a fuck about?
Oh, give a fuck about.
There ain't many. I can't think of any.
Not many.
Q would be around.
Theoretically.
Yeah, but you know.
Unless Picard does something with Q.
Yeah.
Picard's going to do Q. Like, I just can't see them not using Q.
I mean, this is another comic book thing to me, because I remember, like, you know, when there's always been a lot of conversation in writers' rooms when you're writing comics about which characters can I use. Like, if you're on Spider-Man and you're writing one of Spider-Man's five monthly books, right? And you're like, I really want to use Dr. Octopus. And someone's like, well, you can't use him because I've got him slated to come out a year from now, and I need him. So the editor-in-chief has to decide which book gets which character, right? Well, now that CBS is putting out five different Star Trek shows, they're having that conversation, which they didn't have to have in the first season when Discovery was just Discovery. They could do whatever they want. They could go, we're going to go to the Mirror Universe for six episodes. Okay. But now they can't say, well, I want Q to show up, because you know that the Picard crew is saying, oh, you can't touch Q. Take your hands away.
Q, we got Guinan.
Yeah. Well, we got Guinan. We're going to get Q. Like, Q's a, we can't have him. That's also probably why you can't have the Borg. Because
again, it'll be funny. There you go. Guinan. She's a Maul.
Oh, Guinan's a great example. Yes, you're right.
There you go. She's a Maul. She could be Sarah Discovery. Or at least Ella Warren could be. But yeah. The crazy thing you're saying about Q as well, Q being not be like, it, as go for the comics analogy, the idea of having like Spider-Man's rogues gallery, it's like, okay, yeah. You're going to, you know, when you, you know, the X-Men fight Doctor Doom, it's like a weird thing because it's like you're a Fantastic Four villain. So, but the idea that they got Q on Lower Decks before they got him on Picard, that's. Oh, that's a stinger.
Well, so, you have to watch that show when it comes out.
But more importantly, yeah, with the inclusion of the Trill, like, we're looking at it as excited fanboys trying to, like, connect dots and trying to...
Yeah.
The really important thing about the Trill and why I think it's going to speak to this audience is it's going to allow for an exploration of sexual identity. What does it mean to be one gender and not relate to that gender because you relate to another gender?
Yeah.
Like, that is going to be the space that the Trill open up, because we now have a vocabulary and we now have a willingness to have that conversation that we didn't have in the Borman era. Like, Rick Borman did not want any homosexuality in Star Trek.
Right.
Okay. Am I wrong in thinking have they not just announced not a couple weeks ago they were going to have a non-binary character in a show?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that Discovery or is that Picard?
Because that's Discovery.
That would be perfect. The idea that they are a Trill and they've lived through so many lives and they do not identify because they've got so much memories of previous lives would at least give a good reason for it. And I think that, like you say, it's a way of doing it. I mean, it's a round the houses way of doing it, instead of just having a non-binary character that just doesn't happen to have to be an alien. But at least there is that one way of saying, well, I've had relationships with guys, I've had relationships with girls, because I'm 1,800 years old. What do you expect me to do with my time? So it's just, it's a weird, we'll still see.
Well, the Trill character and the non-binary character are two different characters.
Oh, they are different.
They're friends. They're shown together in the trailer scene. They're leaning into it and they're having a conversation.
Well, I've literally seen nothing of any crew, any plots or anything. So, yeah.
But they're all separate characters.
So at least they are going to approach it then. Like you say, it's another one of those things they can do that hasn't been done before. And why the hell not? Go for it. Yeah.
So, well, I'm excited for Discovery.
Yeah, I am too.
Having watched, like I know you just said that you like Discovery season one more than I do, and that's probably true. But I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good.
This rewatch with time and distance and being able to just enjoy the show for what it is and not my expectations as a fan. When there was no Star Trek since 2005's Enterprise. And this is the new Star Trek you're giving me, and I don't quite understand what these Klingons are. And I don't quite understand what these uniforms are. And why are there ghost holograms? Like, and I was able to just let all that go and just be like, this is just a show, and this is Star Trek, and I'm going to enjoy it.
The Klingon thing is a classic example of why I call this a Star Trek just-so story. Because that somehow the writers decided they had to explain why are Klingons the way they are. And that, I don't think that's a question that actually needed answering, but they decided they needed to answer it. Just as they were asking, why is the Federation the way the Federation is? What does it mean to be a Federation? Well, then they asked, what does it mean to be Klingon? And so they start off as these bald creatures that are less recognizable than they were. But the introduction of Tyler, who's like the second in command of the Klingon Empire by the end of his story, and then suddenly all the Klingons start growing hair. Like, this is not rocket science, guys. This is exactly, like, they're growing hair because, like, their leader is hairy, right? And it,
and it makes sense to me. I'm not saying I needed an answer to the question of, you know, why dogs can't talk, but that's the story that they gave us, and it's okay. I can live with it.
But when Discovery does that, because Discovery does it twice. It does it in the Lethe episode, which I've already raved about, and I think is great in terms of opening space for why Sarek is the way he is, told Spock.
Yeah.
Re-examining that storyline. But they also gave space for the reason why Spock kidnaps an aging, dying Captain Pike and gives him to the Talosians. Like, there's no reason for that in the episode of Menagerie. We'd have no idea why Spock would do that. The question isn't ever asked, why is Spock doing this? Like, how does Spock know that the Talosians will help Captain Pike? They wanted to enslave him. But now we have the space because the Talosians can get something from Pike. They can feel his pain and experience empathy through television, which is what we're all doing at this moment in time. Yeah. They can get that with Pike, but also Pike gets to have a body. Pike gets to be able again.
Yeah.
And that's what that episode does, is it gives us a reason why Spock does his actions in the two portal, that Spock is just doing it because Star Trek's run out of money and they need a clip show.
So that's a good answer to the Just So story, right? Yeah. Like, that's a good use of that. Yeah. Everybody, thanks so much for watching. We've gone about an hour and a quarter now, so we're going to wrap up and let you guys go. But we won't be back next Saturday because Discovery comes out a week from Sunday. But then we'll be back after that show is over.
Discovery comes out Thursday.
I thought it comes out a week from Sunday.
Yeah, no, I get it in the UK on Friday, so yeah, I guess you guys get it first. If we get it first, I'll be very surprised.
Right, well, there you go. So I gave bad info from the very beginning. I sit corrected. We will be back next week with another episode, but and we're going to do some analysis of the first episode of season 3 of Discovery. It looks pretty good. I'm excited to watch it, and we will see you guys here as well. Thanks again, everybody. Live long and prosper.